You're here with Stuttering 101. I'm Peter Reitzis, here with my very good friend, Eric Jackson.
Hey, dude.
Hey, Eric. And our very special return guest, Dr. Scott Yaris.
Hello.
Hey, Scott.
Hey, Scott.
Hi. How you doing?
Good, good, good. Thanks.
Good. Very nice to be here. Good.
Dr. Scott Yaris is an associate professor of communication sciences and disorders at the University of Pittsburgh, associate director of audiology and communication disorders at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, and co-director of the Stuttering Center of Western Pennsylvania. Dr. Yaris is a board-recognized specialist and mentor in fluency disorders, has published numerous articles on stuttering, and is a frequent presenter helping clinicians feel more comfortable working with individuals who stutter. Scott is the co-author of The Source for Stuttering, Ages 7 to 18, and the OASIS, the Overall Assessment of the Speaker's Experience of Stuttering.
Yeah, you know, we're going to have a lot of links up for Dr. Yaris. So if you go to Stuttering 101, episode 18, there's going to be links to articles he's written and handouts and his website and his email address and lots of good stuff. So Dr. Yaris, we want to talk to you today about risk factors and recovery for preschoolers who stutter. And our first question is, what is the difference between early childhood stuttering and normal speech?
That's a great question, and it turns out a really difficult one to answer. You know, in the history of the field, initially, Wendell Johnson, who did so much work on the early understanding of stuttering, really felt that there was no difference in terms of the speech behavior. He was struck by the fact that there was notable overlap in the fact that kids were disfluent. They had disruptions in their speech. And whether they stuttered or not, they had disruptions, and these disruptions were similar in many ways. And that idea that there was really no distinction kind of shaped the field for quite some time. These days, we do look at it a little bit differently. These days, we can say that there are differences in the predominant types of disfluencies that children exhibit, whether they're children who stutter or children who don't. So, for example, we tend to see things like part word repetitions, like this, in children who are stuttering, whereas in children who are not stuttering, they're still disfluent, but you would be more likely to see something like this, like this, like this, where it's a repetition of a phrase. Early on, when Johnson was looking at this in the 1950s, that distinction wasn't as clear. But today, we can say, oh yeah, when you're looking at a child who stutters, there are certain types of behaviors that you're more likely to see. Part word repetitions, prolongations where sound is stretched out too long, or what we might call blocks or an inaudible prolongation like this where no sound comes out at all. Those are the kinds of things that you see in children who are stuttering, as opposed to in children who aren't stuttering, they're still disfluent, but you see disruptions involving larger units like repetitions of phrases or revising what they say, because we all make mistakes and change what we say from time to time. So one of the differences has to do with the surface features that you see. All children produce all kinds of disfluencies, but you tend to see a distinction between those children who we would call stuttering and those children who we would say are disfluent normally, but not actually stuttering.
You're listening to Stuttering 101 with Dr. Scott Yaris. Dr. Yaris, what are the risk factors for early childhood stuttering?
Another good question. See, here's the thing, is that we know that lots of children go through a period of increased disfluency in their early life. It's normal, in fact, as they are learning to put sounds together, to make words, as they're learning to put words together to make sentences, as their speech abilities and their language abilities are developing, they tend to make mistakes. It's normal. And correcting those mistakes results in disruptions in speech, or what we call disfluencies. So we have to begin to think then about, all right, well, if lots of kids are disfluent, although some of those kids, they're a little different because they exhibit those part word repetitions and prolongations and blocks. Well, what is it that makes those kids do that as opposed to the normal types of disfluencies? And there's been a lot of research on this. We still don't have definitive answers. However, we can say that there are certain things that we know. First of all, stuttering tends to run in families. We've known this for years, but in fact, these days, the research has become quite clear, indicating that there is a genetic component to most stuttering. In fact, most of the time, if you have one person who stutters in a family, you can find another person in the child's immediate family 60% of the time to 70% of the time who also stutters. So that's not just an environmental coincidence. That's not just the environment they grew up in. There is a genetic component. In my family, for example, my grandfather stuttered all his life. We don't know about anybody above my grandfather, before my grandfather. My grandfather stuttered. My father didn't, but my father's older brother, my uncle, he did for a period of time. He doesn't presently. I didn't. My daughters, my older daughter did for a period of time. My younger daughter didn't. So it's that way. It's distributed through the family, and there is a strong genetic component. But that genetic concordance at maybe 60 to 70%, that's not 100%. And so that means that there's something else going on. People typically talk about some environmental feature, or I think perhaps better, some experiential feature. It's not just where you are. It's what happens to you while you're there that makes a difference. So we talk about risk factors. There's something genetic. There's not just genetics. There's something experiential. And it seems to have to do with the child's development of his language abilities, the child's development of his motor abilities, the child's development, and there's a lot of research on this most recently, the child's development of his temperament, of how he reacts to any difficulties that he experiences in his speech. These and probably other factors combine to differentiate whether the child is going to be disfluent, as all children are, but have those disfluencies be the stuttered kinds of disfluencies, versus being disfluent and having them be the more typical kinds of disfluencies.
Dr. Yaris, I have a question to ask you, but I want to say first that you can be found at stutteringcenter.org. And to contact Dr. Yaris, go to or email jsyaris@pitt.edu. jsyaruss@pitt.edu. As a speech pathologist, I hear speech therapists say time and time again that they have a client, a preschooler, who kind of stutters. Is there such a thing as, I mean, like, is that like being kind of pregnant or?
Yeah, you know what, it's really interesting. Our field has had this taboo about calling somebody a stutterer or a person who stutters. I'm not trying to hear about the person first aspect of that. There was this fear for decades, I mean for half a century, about ultimately labeling a child as a stutterer or one who stutters, and that traces back to some of the older theories that suggested that this might actually contribute to the problem, in fact maybe even cause the problem. Well, we know today that that's not true, but that fear lingers, and so you'll hear speech therapists say all sorts of crazy things trying not to say, I think the kid is stuttering. And they'll say, he kind of stutters, he sort of stutters, it's normal developmental disfluency, it's non-fluent, it's DYS fluent, dice fluent, as my buddy Bob Quisel likes to say. They're trying to do anything except come out and say, yeah, he's exhibiting some pretty atypical speech behaviors there. I think that's stuttering, which, you know, if I see those kinds of behaviors in a young child's speech, I wouldn't be afraid to say this is something that we need to be aware of and be watching. So I wonder if it might trace back to some of that where, you know, there's this discomfort to just come out and say stuttering. And I think overcoming that discomfort is a very important first step in becoming a good therapist for people who stutter, is to be able to just say, oh, you know, that's the behavior, that's what the kid's doing. He's stuttering right there, and we want to help him. Because the real distinction is not whether or not the child is stuttering now. Now, that's fairly easy to tell. You just look at his speech. The tough question is whether or not he's going to continue stuttering. Because what we know is that a lot of children who stutter also recover from stuttering.
And let's kind of go with that a little bit. Can you talk about what we know about recovery from stuttering, Dr. Yaris?
You bet. As I mentioned, a lot of children that go through a period of stuttering. However, the vast majority of them recover. And there's been quite a bit of research on this, done largely by Ehud Yairi and his team. Dr. Ehud Yairi at the University of Illinois has been looking at this for really more than a decade now, looking at what factors might contribute to persistence, continued stuttering, or recovery. And it turns out that there are some things that put a child more at risk for continuing to stutter. For example, we talked earlier about the genes. There does seem to be a genetic component here. For example, in girls, if there is another female family member who continued stuttering, then it's more likely that that young female child will also continue stuttering. This is studied in the absence of treatment, so that doesn't mean that there's nothing we can do to help, but it means left to their own devices, there are certain risk factors that make chronic stuttering more likely. In general, in the studies that Dr. Yairi has done, it looks like something along the lines of about three-quarters of children who go through a period of stuttering ultimately recover even without therapy. Three-quarters is a really high number. And, of course, this is good news because we want these kids to recover. The bad news for us as diagnosticians is that there's no single factor that we can point to. There's no clear-cut distinction when you first look at them between the children who are going to persist and the children who are going to recover on their own. So we end up engaging in some guesswork to try to figure out which children most need our services, and it makes that part a little bit harder. I tend to be more, perhaps, liberal in my application of therapy because I'd rather give a child therapy even if maybe she or he would recover on their own because we can help them feel better quicker. Other people would say, no, you really ought to wait and see who's really confirmed and definitely going to keep stuttering before you apply therapy. I am not as comfortable with the risk that involves. But at this point, what we know about recovery is that lots of kids recover. Certain factors do contribute to a better chance of recovery. For example, if you have a child who stutters but there's no family history, his chance of recovery is better. Girls tend to recover more than boys. The earlier they start stuttering, the younger they are, that speaks well. Although on the flip side, the older they are, the more we can do with them in therapy to help them achieve that recovery. Things like concomitant language and speech disorders actually make it less likely that the child is going to recover. And perhaps things like a highly reactive or a highly sensitive temperament in a child who already stutters. It doesn't cause stuttering, but it may make it harder for him to recover, for him to accept the disruptions that he's having in his speech. He may be more likely to react strongly with tension and struggle. And these are, of course, behaviors that we see in more advanced stuttering. So a lot of research still going on this notion of persistence and recovery. It's important to us not just from a theoretical standpoint of understanding the disorder, but from a clinical standpoint of knowing who we should recommend for treatment in those early years. A lot of debate on this in the literature, a lot of disagreement, but fortunately also a lot of research trying to help us understand better how stuttering develops and what's going on when it persists.
You're listening to Stuttering 101 with Dr. Scott Yaris as our special guest. We can be contacted at 206-888-4619. Can we ask you a few more questions, Scott?
Oh, you bet.
My understanding of the Yairi and Ambrose research is that I believe they found that when preschoolers stutter a lot, what we sometimes refer to as severe stuttering, or when they demonstrate secondary behaviors, these things are not indicative of chronic stuttering. Does that pan out in the work that you've done with preschoolers who stutter?
Absolutely. And isn't that a terrific finding? I mean, it's one of my favorite findings in all the literature. It's also one of my least favorite, but just for a personal reason. I had published a paper in 1998 suggesting that the severity of stuttering might be related to the need for therapy. And then just after that, in 89, Irene Ambrose pointed out that, no, not really. Sometimes these kids recover, even if they stutter severely. And I think that is terrific, because what that means is that I can tell a parent who comes in for an evaluation, who is really in crisis because her child is stuttering severely, I can tell her with all honesty, the fact that your child is stuttering severely right now does not in and of itself mean that your child is always going to stutter. It may look bad now, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a tremendous amount that can be done to improve fluency. The fact that he's struggling now doesn't mean that he might still not recover. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm just going to sit back and say, oh, well, who cares? We don't have to do anything. We still want to help because the family's still in crisis. The family's still frightened. But it also offers a hope that they might not have felt otherwise. It also really highlights my own biases about understanding stuttering, suggesting that, you know, the surface features, they really don't tell you all that much in and of themselves. Now, that said, I want to be very current. I just got a notification of an article just yesterday published by Barry Guitar, and I don't know the co-author, pointing out that one of the predictive factors for success with Lidcombe therapy was indeed severity of stuttering. So this is going to be one of those areas where we continue to have to need more data, continue to have different ways of interpreting the findings or different understandings of the findings till we figure out exactly what the factors are that contribute to recovery. But I feel that Irene Ambrose's findings are absolutely important to understanding very early stuttering, the preschoolers. The mere presence of severe stuttering does not predict chronicity.
Can we just stay on this a little bit longer? I kind of find that a little hard to grasp or believe, I'll say. If a child, and we've all seen 2.5-year-old children, 3-year-old children exhibiting secondary behaviors to stuttering, whether it's stopping when they're struggling, looking down at the ground, when they can't say a word and not finishing, is what we're really saying here that regardless of the way a young child is reacting to stuttering, that has no indicator on whether or not this will be chronic stuttering?
Yeah, pretty much. And here's why I think we can say that. And that is, really young kids are remarkably resilient. So, for example, you've probably seen a child. In fact, I saw this yesterday. Day before yesterday, I was picking up my girls at school, and there was one of the younger ones out in the lobby area where I was. And she was just destroyed over the fact that her cookie had broken. Just destroyed, crying, screaming, on the floor, upset, because her cookie had broken. Well, I remember those feelings, but she's going to recover from that, and quite well. Within 15 minutes, she probably wouldn't even remember the experience. Little kids can be extraordinarily resilient. And the idea is that, right now, I can't get this word out. I'm really frustrated. I'm really upset. I can't get this word out. And a little bit later on, word is coming out just fine. I say, I'm not so frustrated anymore. Now, that doesn't apply as we get much older because we have a memory. And the brain is extraordinarily adept at remembering things that happened to us, bad things, maybe bad things even more than good things. And so the school-age kid, so he's fluent today, but he remembers what happened yesterday. But the little ones, they're a little bit more reactive to the moment and a little bit less affected by the previous moment. Now, I think if these experiences build up over time, then all bets are off. You know, if the child continues to have difficulty, and this is one of the reasons I don't like to wait before giving therapy. You know, if he has difficulty for a few weeks or even a few months, I think that can roll off a lot more easily than if he's having difficulty for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, 9 months, a year. That's one of the reasons that I'm very much against treatment recommendations that in which people say, oh, wait till the child's been stuttering a year before you apply therapy. I think over that kind of time frame, no, any resilience is lost. But if we're talking about a few weeks, a few episodes of very severe stuttering, that in and of itself – I don't think has predictive value. The longer it goes on, though, oh yeah, the more entrenched it becomes.
Dr. Yaris, you published with Craig Coleman and David Hammer a paper in 2006 that's probably going to be a seminal paper in our field. It's titled, Treating Preschool Children Who Stutter, Description and Preliminary Evaluation of a Family-Focused Treatment Approach. Now, we want to get you back on to discuss this in great detail, but why is there this trend to move from just saying treating children who stutter to a family-focused approach? Why is that important?
Oh, good question. A lot of answers to that, but I want to keep it relatively brief for you. The child, the simplest answer is the child spends most of his life with the family when he's at this age. My daughters are older. They spend less time with me now than they do with their friends. But at this age, the 2-year-old, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, the parents, the family is really the focus of the child's life. Any amount of therapy time that I spend with the child, half an hour once a week, twice a week, an hour twice a week, is going to pale in comparison to the time the child spends with the parent. Therefore, one of the things I want to do is I want to enlist the help of the parents in providing an environment of support for the child. And I don't mean just in terms of fluency. I mean in terms of the child's overall healthy communication. And so I want the parent to become the therapist. And so that's one of the reasons we focus on the family, because the parent just plain has more access, and should. I wouldn't want a child in therapy that much. The parent is the one who is with the child. The other reason is parents have concerns, too. And in fact, parents' concerns are often bigger than the child's concerns. The child's 3, you know, his brain's still little. He doesn't yet fully grasp the situation, which is a good thing. It's as he begins to grasp the situation later, as he gets older, that some of the big concerns come into play. But the parent can see, the parent is worried about the future. Will my child ever be able to go to school? Is he going to be picked on by other kids? Will he be able to get a job? Will he get married? You know, will he be able to be in the service? Will he be able to go to college? The parents have significant fears as well, and we want to address those. My goal as a therapist is not just to fix the child's fluency. That's part of it, if we can. My goal is to help the family system deal with and react to and cope with this communication difficulty they're having. So we work directly with the parent as well to help the parent, because not only does that help the parent, then it also helps the parent help the child. So in my opinion, we need the whole family when we can get them. Sometimes we can't. Sometimes we do work with the child only. We need to have that option if for some reason the parent can't be involved. But if they can, the focus on the entire family and the family system, the communication system, is where I want to put my effort.
Wow. There are so many more questions we want to ask you, but I think we're going to have to leave it there.
Fair enough. I can go on and on and on. I enjoy doing this. This is great fun.
You've been listening to Stuttering 101 with Dr. Scott Yaris. Dr. Yaris can be reached www.stutteringcenter.org or via email jsyaris, that's jsyarus, at pitt.edu. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Yaris.
Sure, yeah. Oh, thanks for having me. This has been great fun.
Thanks.